Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is December 29th, 2025, and this is episode 570. I am your ailing co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Western New York State, ground zero of a new influenza pandemic, by the way. And you're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe. Please catch the last few shows before we die. Subscribe at patreon.com/RadioWarnerd. And I'm on the line with the Warnerd, who's back. John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in southern Italy. And John, I mean, my, how the turntables have turned, as Michael Scott would say, because, yeah, you're the healthy guy, and I am the basket case now.
Well, yeah, you're not basket case, but yeah, you do sound pretty rough. And I feel pretty okay. I mean, there is this new dent, like people used to put in their hats, you know, 50 years ago, right in the middle of the scalp. But otherwise, I feel okay.
You know, I didn't get a chance to say this last time because I've been sick. I'll explain it in a minute. I mean, I'm hit by both a parasite and influenza, and I'll get to that. But I want to recognize, first of all, your incredible recovery. Like, this is like, I don't know, this is like something from ABC Wide World of Sports or something. Like, your comeback is, it was not expected, and it's pretty incredible. Right. Like, we expected you to come back, it's just that we thought it was going to take months. And your first, you know, in those first few weeks when you were in the hospital and your first week out of the hospital all suggested that that prognosis was correct. And that you were going to make a full recovery. And I kept telling people, but I just said, you got to give John a very slow return and it's going to take months. And instead, you came, you know, roaring back. And because my brain isn't working, I can't think of a single fucking analogy from movies or sports or anything. But people can think of their analogies themselves. But I just want to say, like, congratulations on that, because that's really amazing how you have come back.
Yeah, I guess they were giving me really good care. I just didn't notice. I was sort of furious to be cooped up in a bed all the time in a ward where I had nothing to read, and there wasn't even any TV. I guess it paid off. Looking at the ceiling.
Yeah, it's so that's the great news. And I don't mean to hog any of the limelight, because this is my problems are still a lot less than bleeding in the cranium and drills into the cranium. But there were some Radio Warnerd subscribers who thought, this doesn't sound like your standard food poisoning. It sounds like parasites. And when I heard parasites, my first thought was, you mean worms. I mean, that's the first thought that comes in your mind when you think of, I don't know, when I do anyway, and you just immediately have a picture in your head and you can see the Google image online of, like, worms. But that's not it. It turns out I have Giardia. And that's the parasite that I got from the food, apparently, which is really weird, too.
What kind of organism is Giardia?
What's it called again? A protist, I think. Actually looked it up. It's a single cell. It's like in the same, it's an amoeba, or in the amoeba kind of protozoa amoeba family. But, you know, classifications start to really, like, they're pretty neat taxonomies when you go animal kingdom, plant kingdom, fungus kingdom. And then after that, there's a gazillion other things in this planet, and they don't really seem to know. I was trying, like protos, like the Giardiasis or whatever the hell, the bug, this creature or thing, it's in the same general field as slime mold.
Not the Ganymedian slime mold.
Yes, I was thinking the same thing. I know, poor...
poor Lord Running Clam.
Yes. and Kelp, which also bummed me. I was like, poor Kelp. I like Kelp, yeah. You know?
Except it hides Great Whites off.
Okay.
Off the, I mean, somebody last week or the week before was training for one of those triathlons when something in her part of the water erupted like a big grenade dropped in the water. And that was her getting, unfortunately, chomped by a great white.
Yeah. Well, they also help seals or otters, sea otters hide from great whites.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, the sea otters, that's why I like kelp, because you watch those films in grammar school, right? Or whatever, high school.
Like, oh, in my grammar school, I mean, the fact that there were sea otters still left alive was a big thing.
Yeah. And it was the kelp. Like, it was always the symbiosis between the sea otter and the kelp off of Monterey. I did what you do. I found a few like electronic microscope images of the Giardia bug, and it's pretty gross. It's like, so it's this single cell creature, but it has a shell, as naturally, because God is great. He would give them a shell. And they have a shell, and then they have these like dangly little tentacle feelers, whatever the hell it is, that dangle out of this single cell creature. It's really just horrible. And they go into the small intestine, and as far as I can tell, I guess they feed off of the cilia in the small intestine, so that way you can't absorb anything anymore. And that's why you vomit and diarrhea and have constant nausea and stuff. And so I'm on this incredibly bland diet, but I've lost so much weight. Then I got influenza A, this influenza that's going around, and I've never had an influenza like this. No, our whole house was like a freaking field hospital, and everybody, my wife, my mother-in-law was staying with us, and then she just stayed in our guest bedroom there. When you get at the peak of this thing, you just don't get out of bed for 3 days, and you look like... it recalled for me the way my wife and my mother-in-law looked. It was pretty scary. Like, it looked like, you remember in George Romero's version of the only really, you know, real version of Dawn of the Dead, when they're when they're dying and they're sallow, and it's like a shade of white of pasty, greasy white. Like, it's so...
Oh, yeah. When that guy is dying, it's one of the best scenes ever in any movie. Like... He says to his army friend, "I'm going to try real hard to come back."
Yes.
And the army friend just nods and waits for him to die, and then shoots him in the head.
Yep. I've lost now. I've lost at least 10 pounds. Like, I look like a Mike Pompeo version of me. Like, you know, the Ozempic... I don't know if you've seen what Ozempic people look like. Like, it's like, you don't look healthy. I know it's good, you lose weight and everything, but you don't look young when you lose weight from Ozempic. You look like somebody put a needle in you and sucked out a bunch of air, and
maybe Giardia is going to be the new Ozempic.
I know, this is the budget Ozempic. If you don't have the money for this, just go to Wegmans and buy a salmon poke bowl. I actually got a call from the Monroe County Health Office because I tested positive for Giardia, you know, just went through everything with them. And the influenza. The one thing I'll say about the influenza, which has been so weird, is that at kind of the peak of it, I had these strange, and my wife told me she had the same thing, these strange periods of literally like nodding off. We had bad, you know, fevers. And I've had fevers and kind of even sort of, I don't know, weird dreamy or hallucinatory kind of fevers. But this was, I swear to God, like an opiate. I mean, it was not unpleasant. It was kind of pleasant. It was very opiate-like. I've never had that from a fever before. Have you ever had that where you're... And I was like, this seems familiar. This feels kind of good.
Well, it's funny you should say that because I had the only dreams that I was convinced were reality while in the hospital ward. And without going into details, they were scary enough that I thought I would have to flee the country or something. And then I realized, wait, I didn't actually do any of those things. So that's good.
Yeah. But these were more like, again, like kind of opioid, like more positive, floaty, dreamy feelings from the fever. I've never had that before. It's very strange. I've had the hallucinatory, the very unpleasant hallucinatory ones. So that's at least the upside to influenza. Yeah. But otherwise, yeah, you know, all the other stuff goes with it. Hacking so hard, like I have like bros who try to do 6-pack ab crunches. Probably get a stomach that feels like mine because my stomach muscles are so sore that I almost cry if I cough, you know, and and one of my sons has it. It's really painful.
You can try to retain the health benefits of this.
I know.
You're 10 pounds lighter and you've got those legendary rock hard abs,
so flyweight MMA, get destroyed in 1 second. Oh boy, yeah, I know. It's it is always good to lose some weight. I mean, if you read those studies like where they starve mice and the mice live longer, and it's like, huh, maybe I shouldn't eat 4 packs of Lay's potato chips.
Korean war prisoners in a famous study, they had no health care, they were starved and abused in general, but they lived on average at least a year longer.
Wow.
Their compatriots who'd never been imprisoned.
Wow. So 2025 ends with your humble co-hosts in bad condition. So
yeah, can it get we're damaged. The world is damaged.
Oh man!
All I can say is what Hunter Thompson's attorney said. God damn! What a bummer.
I mean, just looking through the notes of 2025. We've said this most years, I think, since we started the show, but it definitely accelerated the worsening, the entropy, the horribleness of everything. It's just gotten worse and worse. This really was a fucking awful year. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think to me the most remarkable development has been gloves off. We're not going to pretend anymore. We're making Barry Weiss the head of CBS News, and we don't care if she's a hopeless idiot. She has views that we like. We don't care anymore if we're going to kill a lot of people. I mean, you sent me a story that really shocked me, that most Sunday afternoon talk shows in the U.S. have not featured one single Palestinian spokesperson. Yeah.
The newsmaker shows, the Sunday morning, which it's funny, those used to be much bigger than they are now, but among the kind of the elites, the people who are, I mean, newsmakers, so the people who do have power, it's still as big a deal, those Sunday morning shows, as they've ever been. I think people who are younger, let's say millennials and younger, would probably be surprised to know that. I mean, these Sunday morning, Face the Nation, Meet the News, I mean, these were actual newsmaker shows. Like
When I was a child, I knew that people, unimaginably dull people, watched them back in the East somewhere, but I couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, I mean, as I recall, like during W's administration, Cheney used Meet the Press to advance like various propaganda lines about Saddam Hussein's, you know, developing nuclear weapons, like basically WMD lies and Saddam Hussein al-Qaeda lies. And that's where the impact was kind of strongest, was using like Meet the Press. So yeah, so not having a single Palestinian on, and I think the only network in the 2 years of the genocide that did, I think it might have been CBS, had a Palestinian on once or twice, but the other ones didn't have a single one on. It is shocking.
It is remarkable. Like, they've embraced the fact that stories tend to have two sides, the ultimate journalism 101 cliche. At least I hope it is still. And yet not in this area.
It says to me, because, you know, I remember in the first Intifada and maybe even the second one, like they would have Hanan Ashwari. They would have some Palestinian voices on. It's not that they were in any way at all more sympathetic to Palestinians. As you said, they were kind of adhering to their own stated principles a little bit more, because they were more confident. And I think that's exactly right.
Like, this was, there were two sides to this. One, on the battlefield, the Palestinians put up quite a struggle and initially were seemingly victorious. I don't think they ever could have been, but they looked like it. And the other one was, I think, the more alarming one, which is at home, public opinion, as it's called, turned out to be uncontrollable. That's why they had to close down TikTok and other media that couldn't be gatekept in a simple way. And that was really alarming.
Hillary Clinton, I think, recently came out and said, the problem is younger people are seeing, you know, dead Palestinians on TikTok and they just don't understand anything. And I don't know if you saw that. I think this is actually when you were in the throes of your injury. But there was this video that went around of one of Obama's speechwriters speaking at a pro-Israel event, talking about the messaging problem. These people all think everything is a messaging problem.
Right.
There's never substance to anything. It's always messaging. Like, the Democrats think they lost in 24 because of messaging. And the way to win it in 26 and 28 is messaging. But anyway, she said, how can I counter young people who see on their phone, you know, nothing but dead Palestinian babies. They're scrolling through their phone. It's dead Palestinian babies. This is the problem I'm facing. Like, not that the problem is dead Palestinian babies, but that she's having a messaging problem with the dead Palestinian babies. And it's really how they think.
It's very strange. Like, I guess you just blink past them if you're within that bubble.
Yes.
They don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah,
it's still kind of alarming. There's something kind of weird about those people in general, those who are within the blob.
Yeah, very weird. And you know, and this whole mask off thing. I mean, it's there's sort of one faction, let's say the Democratic faction, which thinks they can temporarily take the mask off for this one issue or for a couple of issues, but otherwise keep the mask on because it's important for them and important for how they think, basically, rule. And then there's the Trump side, which hates the mask and has gone mask off. And there's this sense, though, that like going mask off will lead to something cathartic.
Yeah.
And there's nothing cathartic about it that I can tell.
I think for sane people, there isn't.
Yeah.
But I remember constantly these days, passage in Orwell's 1984. And I don't endorse 1984 as a novel in every way, but there is a beautiful description of the scene in a movie theater where there's a newsreel of the destruction of a refugee boat, boat full of civilian refugees, and this helicopter comes over and just drops a bomb on it, and the theater goes wild. I mean, everybody erupts in cheers. And I think there is a reaction a lot like that, because when you don't have much connection with the world in any way, you don't work with people. A lot of these people, you know, they're retired or they're rich enough to be insulated in some other way. And they will believe anything, really. And so that they can believe there are millions of boats coming to the U.S. to somehow, at gunpoint, I suppose, make people take drugs.
Yeah, I don't remember that scene from 1984. By the way, John, maybe we should try and find, John has written a great piece on Orwell and Chris Hitchens that I think really held up well. I mean, Orwell's frustrating because he is a very good writer, but I don't think it's just no coincidence that the most horrible people always reference him. And Animal Farm, I mean, put it this way, when I was a young reactionary, I loved Animal Farm. I remember reading it, I think, when I was 13. And I was like, yeah. And I mean, like, assaulted my nice English teacher. And she was like, she was impressed that I read it and had a sense of the politics of it, but thought I was kind of weird for me. Like,
yeah.
See those bad commies?
She may have been right in the long term. The term was just a little long because it's like 30 years later, she's probably dead now, but you can at least say, see, I did come around. I mean, I sometimes feel like that with my social studies teachers who were almost invariably kindly Midwestern people. And I think also it was kind of a thrill for them to get a snarling maniac who was also fairly articulate, you know, versus like, oh, I don't know, who cares?
Yes.
So they enjoyed it, but it was kind of disappointing to some of them. And yeah, now I have come around, but you know, a little late. Oh, by the way, that essay is called Big Brothers is coming out in a book that I can now announce will be out shortly.
Oh, great. What's the book?
It's called To the Crows. It's from an Athenian curse, like, to the crows with you. And I borrowed it for a pseudonym for an author of something that appeared in one of the things we put out between the closing down of the Exile and the development of the NSFW program. I called myself Ace Korakis.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's what it means in Greek, Ace Korakis. And it's part of a selected essay collection put out with the Observatory in New York. And I hope that one will make some impact. But I don't know. I look at the people who are supposed to be the American essayists right now, and there are a lot of twee, smirking ironists. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't really get it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. A lot of dullness. Oh, man, it's never ends. Good. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. All right. So why don't we try and do a wrap up of the year? As well as we could. And well, we're going to do our best here. Put it this way: we're both injured, but we're doing our best for you. So So let's.
We're limping along with the fife and the drum, and doing our best. Yeah. And I think the first war to deal with, because of its impact on the United States, is the war in Gaza and then in the broader Palestine. And I think the most shocking thing about that, as I implied earlier, has been its impact on the U.S. and both the way that it revealed that some people do care and care a lot and are willing to put their careers on the line for it, and the, for me, much scarier fact that most people don't. They've long since consigned Palestinians to a big bin that's labeled Middle Eastern Muslims, radioactive, do not enter. And they just don't want to deal with that.
It has had some other effects, and we'll see how they play out over time. But it has definitely, probably permanently, hurt Israel's image in the U.S. and the West among the people out of power, among the people who probably will never be in power, at least not for a while. And really, like, in one of the starkest ways has clarified that gap between the elites and the rest. And people, I mean, the elites don't care about Palestinians. They don't think they're humans. They think they're in the way. And have all those negative that we know, elites in politics, media, business. Academia is a very strange thing because there have been some notable brave people in academia, but what's at least in America, what's really struck me is how many not brave, how many cowardly people in academia who are like, who probably have written books on, the semiotics of radical theory and whatever change and stuff. Yeah. And they just want to keep their sinecures. And that's what they are. They're sinecures. And they have let, because they know that their careers are probably done if they stand up. It's true. Their careers could be done. People have lost their careers. You stand up, you're done.
Yeah, people are not fooling around from the pro-Israeli side anymore. They're going for the career because that's how you get people in America. That's how you terrorize them. But I've wondered myself, tried to check in on the old department back at Berkeley. It's hard to get good information, but I think people are keeping their heads down, yeah.
It has really opened up some fractures on the right that we started talking about all year. I was noticing that early on, and it's become, I think, a much more widely discussed phenomenon, at least outside of the right now, that the American right really is split on this, and the open anti-Semitism, talk about more of this mask off stuff, right? I mean, the Nick Fuentes phenomenon. All of this really goes back to Israel committing a genocide in front of everybody. Suddenly people start questioning a lot of things about Israel and Jews. And like it or not.
As far as I know, that's not Nick Fuentes' obsession, is it? Like, does he care?
I mean, he talks about it. Put it this way. He talks about Israel committing genocide all the time. Yeah. His angle on Jews is he talks about international Jewry. That's the word he uses. International Jewry and...
Yeah, very archaic word.
I know, huh? And, and that Jews are out for themselves as a supranational class or tribe. And, the genocide in Gaza, like the way that they're suppressing or trying to make us not think about it, is all, it's all part of one thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all part of one way of Jews basically looking out for themselves, protecting and growing their power, and intimidating and forcing everybody else, or through, guile or money, whatever, to, like, you know, submit to them, to not pay attention to what they do, and so on and so forth. And because of what's going on now, his argument has a lot more weight than it would otherwise, you know, 10 years ago or 50 years ago.
And yet it's been so clumsy. Like, here, Barry Weiss is now the new head of CBS News because I got the money and I'm just going to put her there. So there.
Exactly. But that's what creates more anti-Semitism. That's what makes people think Fuentes is onto something. I mean, it's the most anti-Semitic paranoid ideas about how shit works is happening in front of our eyes. You know, Jewish billionaire who's the largest private donor to the IDF buys CBS News and puts ultra-Zionist Barry Weiss in charge. And it was pro-Zionist before then, but it wasn't pro-Zionist enough. The Redstones are hardcore Zionists who owned CBS Paramount before. But they weren't like the Ellison level, which is the largest private donor to the IDF.
Right.
And so, you know, it's
and he could have put
insane.
Somebody who had more plausibility as a leading journalist. I mean, Barry Weiss is not that bright.
No, maybe. I don't know. I mean, there's the pessimistic side of me says that I'm sure that, you know, the pro-Israel people, which the pro-Israel people means the ruling class in this country too. You know, they're all one. And so the pro-Israel crowd is thinking with time, you know, with a certain level of repression, with time and a lot of money and buying all this stuff out, all the people complaining now, it's to be expected. But right. In 5 years or 10 years, if we stay on, you know, on target, people will forget about it. Or like there'll be some residue, but they just won't care as much anymore. And they'll get used
to it.
That's
usually
a
good bet.
I know.
In the United States.
I know.
Not sure this time. I came out of the hospital thinking, I bet that's already happened.
Yeah.
And it hadn't.
No, it hasn't happened. And I agree with you. I'm normally pessimistic about things. Things usually turn out the shittiest version possible. But I don't think this is really recoverable for Israel. No. I don't think so. It's just, it's really one of those things. It's like what the young reformers or the neoliberals used to say about the Russians in the early 90s. Like the old generation just has to die off first, and then we'll have this like pro-capitalist, pro-Western Russia that will arise because it's all the fault of, you know, the old. They were wrong on that. But I think in this case it's true. I mean, the prejudices are generational, are deeply generational. And so
I think in a way it's more like people were deprived of the usual news media images of like mangled dead children.
Yes.
And it's not really possible for most people to argue against a child who's been shot 37 times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are so many images that we'll never forget. You know, of course, the image of the Palestinian person in the tent with the ivy connected to him as he's burning alive, and you see his silhouette. I mean, it's just one of many. One thing that's kind of surprised me so far, again, this shows it's you know, our elites, our ruling classes are pretty scary. There have been, I think, one or two. Well, there was a documentary that won. There was a documentary about what's going on in the West Bank with settlers that won an Oscar, but you couldn't get it in a movie theater. Good luck finding it. It's not on HBO. Like they're still like when the Maidan happened or when Russia's full scale invasion 2022 happened, you had documentaries pouring into Netflix and on other streaming channels and winning awards, showing the brave courage of the Azov and the neo-Nazis in Mariupol and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not even joking. I wish I was, but they were. And And you still can't get these on Netflix. So it really is only through social media. And now that Larry Ellison, again, speaking of Barry Weiss and CBS News, basically owns U.S. TikTok. I mean, there have already been reports of how they're squeezing out content or, you know, images from Gaza. It's pretty grim.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It's going to take a while to settle out. But I think it did leave a really traumatic impression in the minds of most yes. news consumers under 40.
Yes, absolutely.
And we'll see how that goes. The other, well, there are many other aspects of the war in Gaza that aren't limited to Gaza. One of them is while people were focused on Gaza, the Syrian government fell and fell to Shara, a very, very friendly jihadi, a jihadi who's been defanged, to say the least, and has now turned Syria into a frontline state on the pro-West side, to the extent that there can be a pro-West side in the Middle East, because they have nothing to thank us for, as a rule. And that's been done almost without a sound, even though there were massacres and killings, probably more than we know, as the jihadis swept south and east from Latakia and the regions around there. It's bizarre, but it helps to have a front guy, and that's what happened there. I was actually getting a lot of flack when this happened, like, don't be such a downer. Finally, Syria's at peace. And yeah, okay, Syria's at something like peace, but sometimes there are delayed killings, delayed waves of killings, and that's sort of happened or begun to happen.
Yeah. There was a bomb and I think it was an Alawite mosque, right, in Homs, I think it was, that killed a bunch of Alawites. And there were massive demonstrations that broke out all across, well, areas where Alawites live. Yeah. We had Joshua Landis on the show a few times. Those are some pretty depressing episodes, I have to say, with
yes,
Joshua.
Very.
Going back to 2024, but his take on it was basically, and same with Cyrus, we had great guest Cyrus on, that Syria is now ruled by a Sunni Salafist supremacist, like a Salafist Sunni supremacist, and that there really is no place for the minorities in Syria anymore, except to maybe keep their heads way down and take it when they get hit every now and then and leave when they're told to leave.
Yeah, and, or leave right now because things are going to get bad inevitably. And that's been happening in Syria to minorities for over a century.
Yeah.
And anybody who has the money to get their family out, they probably will in the years to come. So I don't know. It's a very discouraging development. That is something we can't do much about. And to the extent that people were hoping for the best, I can't really blame them because it was god awful in Syria before this, and just to have the killing and the chaos ending, you can understand why people want that.
I thought it was interesting that, so I don't know if you saw this news, that Israel just recognized the breakaway region of Somaliland in Somalia, which has been trying to break away for a long time, right?
Yeah. Do you understand that? Okay, let's hear it.
So here's what I think anyway. So Somaliland is sort of between Ethiopia, kind of between between the rest of Somalia, Rump Somalia, Puntland, and Djibouti. It's basically on the southern part of the Gulf of Aden, right across from Yemen.
Okay.
The UAE has been investing in supporting Somaliland independence, because as we've talked about, the UAE is building this, you know, maritime empire, and a big part of its statecraft, its imperial statecraft, is breaking up countries and having proxies, you know, that it can do business with within these broken countries. The UAE is, and Israel's interests usually align very closely too, and usually not always with the U.S. as well. So the UAE is both very active in Yemen. I don't know if you saw this. This is right around when you were getting out of the hospital, I think, but the UAE's proxies in southern Yemen around Aden, the STC, you know, they control Socotra, they control the Aden area. They had this big breakout. The UAE-backed forces had a big breakout into the regions, not the Houthi regions, but sort of east and northeast into these more sparsely populated areas that are controlled by the Saudi proxies, which is the so-called internationally recognized government, which exists, I think, you know, as everyone always says, in a Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. But whatever, it's the Saudis, you know, that's their proxies. And the Saudis and the UAE are also kind of fighting an undeclared proxy war in Sudan as well. The UAE is backing the RSF, we'll talk about this, and Saudis back the SAF, the government forces. So the UAE backs the Somaliland breakaway region because they want to control the Gulf of Aden. That's the southern part, and then Aden, which they control through their proxies. So northern part. And the UAE also backs the Ethiopian government.
And, right, they're the wild card in all
a big
this.
One, yes.
Like, yeah, okay, this isn't just a Gulf business. We're moving on up, and we're going to go get some power of our own and get a new port.
Yep. So the Ethiopians signed a deal, I think, to lease some part of the port in Berbera, which is right there on the Gulf of Aden. And that caused almost like set off wars, you know, with Somalia. The Egyptians are scared of the Ethiopians or pissed off at the Ethiopians. Egypt is with the Saudi. Like, it starts getting really kind of World War I-ish like here. Yeah. And the Israelis, what's their interest? Is their interest in this is kind of twofold. I mean, first of all, they're very close to the, you know, they did the Abraham Accords with the UAE. They're very close to the UAE. And their interests really align here. The Israelis and the UAE want to deal, as they would say, deal a punishing blow to the Houthis, and they haven't been able to.
No.
But if they have access, if you look and see how close Berbera is to, you know, to Yemen, I mean, it's just right across the Gulf, then their air assets can much more easily, without having to refuel and all that, like they can cause a lot more damage, put it that way. So, obviously, Israeli recognition, which is roundly denounced by a lot of countries, was not denounced by Syria, by the way, even though most Muslim countries denounced it. Syria didn't denounce it, neither did Ethiopia.
No, you know, for about a month, people who were more or less Islamist were saying, hey, Syria, why haven't you denounced X or Y or whatever that Israel was doing or that was somehow hurting Syrian Muslims? But there was no answer. That's usually the right move, like just don't answer.
Yeah. And so I think, so that's why, I think that's the, everyone assumes that's the quid pro quo. The first quid pro quo is that Israel's going to be there and work with the UAE to bomb the Houthis to, and I think the UAE's goal, again, it's fracture. So I think the UAE is trying to create a situation in Yemen where we'll go back to how it was like in the Cold War era. Southern Yemen will be a UAE proxy state. Northern Yemen can go to hell as far as they're concerned.
That would work out well with Socotra. They really do remind me of the Venetians in their prime. Like, they're willing to carve out like any size of protectorate. Just as long as it's got a coastline and something mm-hmm. behind it.
Yeah. And then there's a potentially darker side to this as well. I don't know if all these are related, but I'm just going to say them anyway. You know, the U.S. this year has bombed Somalia far more than we ever have. In Trump's second term, there's a graph here that Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com posted. Trump is, even in his first term, he made bomb, you know, the anti-war president made bombing Somalia. It's just, it's not being covered for some reason, but the amount of U.S. air drone and ground operations Somalia, like if you look at the graph, it's just, I mean, it just goes off the scale for this year, 2025. So that, to me, that says the U.S. is helping weaken and break up an already extremely weak and broken up Somalia, you know, central state. And there has been a big lobbying push and somehow, and I guess it's the UAE funding it. UAE funds pro-Somaliland lobbyists who then buy out MAGA people who then push for Somaliland to break away. And I think, you know, the UAE is always understood. If you want to advance something, you cut it, you make good with Israel because that gives you a get out of jail free card.
Right.
And so I think the Somaliland wants to have that tie with Israel too. But what Israel, another thing Israel wants from Somaliland is a place to expel the Palestinians in Gaza to. And there's been talk of that that has gone on for a while.
I haven't heard that. That's sinister. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we'll keep an eye on that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the as far as the effort to dislodge the Houthis and stop them from interfering in shipping in the Gulf, that comes back in part to Trump's Golden Fleet idea, which is without doubt the dumbest thing that I've heard in a long while. And there, it's trademark second term Trump, which is like, are we trolling you guys badly enough? Are you mad yet? Can we see you jump up and down like Rumpelstiltskin? Please, come on, throw me a bone here. Because it just doesn't make any sense. The sane parts of the Navy have been trying desperately to say, you can't put every weapon on a single platform. So basically, Trump or somebody like Pete Hegseth or some other genius in his bureaucracy has decided to put everything in one package, like from gigantic guns of the old battleship sort to missiles and every kind of
yes. This? It's like I would try and do a Trump if I wasn't so sick, but yeah, fitted with guns and missiles at the highest level, hypersonic weapons, electric rail guns, cruise missiles, and the most sophisticated lasers in the world.
That's right.
And they'll be very AI controlled, he said, without explanation. And like, I mean, this is again the stuff that 10-year-olds draw on their binders.
It really is
cool. And I just think my best guess is Trump, you know, loves flattery. I mean, it's no secret. He loves to be flattered. He loves big, flashy things, anything with his name on it. And people around him see dollar signs.
And we should
mention,
it's going to be called the Trump.
Yeah. And the people around him see dollar signs. We can do that. You know, we could do that with our eyes closed. $1 trillion, no problem.
Yep.
You know, so yeah, it's.
And so we at least have something to look forward to, i.e. A dirty coughing exhaust Houthi missile just like going in on its last legs, almost out of gas, and blowing the hell out of one of these vessels.
Yeah. No, they won't. They won't let him go near. The Trump vessel will be we'll just be going to like exhibitions.
Because I've been reading U.S. Navy in-house productions, and 10 years ago they were saying, of course, we can't go near the Houthi coast because that would be far too likely to destroy any surface vessel. So they knew this. They knew this all along.
Yeah, and I mean, the money people said pull them out because this could hurt our hurt our baby here, our golden goose. Just get them the hell out of there. All right, I think at this point, let's just take a quick break. We'll listen to some music from our man Brendan Andrig, and then we'll come back and cover some more wars that are going on this year. Okay, we are back. That was music from Brendan Andrig, our amazing sound engineer, and we'll post links to his music. People often ask, what's that great song you guys had? Well, turns out Brendan is a very well-known musician, so we're really lucky to have him. I always like it when Brendan puts his music on our shows. Yeah. Amazing music. So Thanks, Brendan, for that. Brendan, by the way, how was your year? Just gonna ask real quickly.
Oh man, it's been pretty miserable.
Okay, so part. All right, it's a team thing, you know.
Yeah.
All in misery together. John, you wanted to make one brief comment before we go on to part two here. You
right? Yeah, I have to make a tedious correction. The fleet that Trump imagines is going to be called, and what a surprise this was, the Golden Fleet.
Yes.
But the first ship of that fleet, massive ship, insanely massive, is supposed to be called the Defiance, which is just asking for it, if in my opinion. But it's obviously harking back to the imperial dreams of America's early empire phase. I think a lot of people really do want that phase back, a lot of Trump's fan base anyway, because in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt pushed for an American fleet to sail around the world, sort of blustering and showing off. And this was to be called the Great White Fleet, which was in part a reflection of the fact that America was pointing south toward tropical waters, you know, rather than Battleship Gray. So Trump thinking that, no, great, why? Well, sounds like a shark. Well, we can do better than that. It's got to be Golden Fleet, because being the cheesiest bastard in the world, everything he touches has to be either gold or gilded.
Yeah. Only one other thing I'd add. There's so much to add about Gaza. We're going to do it more in-depth episodes, everyone, like on Gaza. We'll do more on Venezuela. We'll do more on Ukraine and stuff. But just one thing that I didn't want to leave off before we move on, a couple of things, actually. One is, as somebody pointed out, Israel in this genocide, in this war, killed not just 240 plus journalists, which is absolutely unprecedented in any war at all. And all of the Western journalists who always bray for, you know, journalist rights. And if a single journalist is hurt, it hurts all of us. Complete silence again.
Yep.
But not only they killed that many journalists, they've killed 750 members of journalists' families. And there were, and I think there were explicit, you know, threats also targeting their families and killing them. This is just, again, you know, yeah, as you said, gloves off, mask off, all this stuff. Like, that's what it looks like. You know? Yeah. It's what it looks like, and no consequences. I mean, that's
not even a public response from most journalists. I admit I don't fully understand it because I don't know. I sort of imagine that even if I don't know, we're in that business. I mean, presumably they have money in the bank already, right? They could survive for a while. But.
Well, I try to chalk it up to a few things. One is kind of elite selection. These people generally come from the same very small handful of schools. Usually their parents or something like that were... I'm talking about in the elite journalism world, right? So they're all family connected. So, you know, that's one thing. Another thing is that if you're not from that, there are very few good journalism jobs anymore. You can, you know, Substack, and there are people that have made careers, and we did, and, you know, Patreon, but we don't get published. Like, I used to get published in what was left of some of the somewhat mainstream outlets. They don't anymore. There's just not much left there, and a lot of it got purged. So there's that too, and you know, just fear of career. And then there's a lot of people, which I guess circles back to number one, who are, because they're from that elite world, they are Zionists to one degree or another. They are Zionists.
Who's that white-haired weirdo? Anderson Cooper.
Yeah.
He actually silenced a black woman on a panel show that tried to express compassion for some of the dead in Gaza. And he was not shy about it. And she sort of deferred to him.
And he either, he had some connection to the CIA early in his career. He was briefly in it. This doesn't mean it's a CIA operation. It means this is where, this is the thinking, the mentality, and the culture, the cultural background. Like, the inputs that go into this guy are the same inputs that had him sign up for the CIA. That's not, a journalist should be in absolute opposition to the CIA. And just as a journalist in Russia should be in the opposition to the FSB. Like, that's just a basic thing. But, I mean, that people don't even believe, liberals don't even believe that anymore, which is one of the many weird breakdowns
that,
of everything.
That was a weird moment when they just decided Russians should be brave opposition figures to the death, and they meant to the death.
Yes.
But we aren't even going to squeak.
So, anyways, so there's that, and the other thing I wanted to say is that Israel, in this ceasefire that Trump arranged, a so-called ceasefire in October, which seems to be holding because it's the old you cease and we fire type of Israeli ceasefire. Since then, I think the Israelis have killed close to 400 directly Palestinians in Gaza. But more importantly, they're making life uninhabitable there. They've also taken something like 58%. So they keep circumscribing how much of Gaza is allowed to Palestinians. And they draw what's called the yellow line around it. Anybody who crosses it gets shot. And that already encompasses 58% of Gaza, which is already a tiny strip. So the Palestinians are now down to 42% of Gaza, living in tents because the Israelis won't let in most of the aid, including housing construction materials. So they have to live in tents. And you've probably seen the scenes of floods and rains, cold rains. Something like 15 infants have died so far this month just from hypothermia in Gaza. I mean, can you imagine one Israeli Jewish baby dying of hypothermia due to Hamas or Palestinians? We would never hear the end of it. But they don't even, I had to find this deep in an article somewhere, that 15 Palestinian babies, because they're not human in our press. Anyway, so.
It's kind of scary.
It is. It is.
When you step back from it and look at a distance, it's very bad.
So let's move on to a few other conflicts, end of the year roundups, I guess. Ukraine, Russia. I mean, we'll do another more in-depth roundup probably in January. We'll need to. But just as we're recording this, Zelensky came out to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump and discuss whatever the latest 20-point. It's always either a 20-point plan or a 28-point plan. And, Putin called just before. Putin does this. He calls just before Zelensky arrives to get in his side of the story, I guess. But I'm going to go back to what I've said from the very beginning of Trump's term, which is I don't see any peace deal really being possible. Like, this is one of those wars where it's most likely the facts on the ground are going to have to decide the outcome. And we're probably still not there yet. I think Trump is horrible in 1,000 different ways, but I do think it's a great thing that he's trying to bring peace there. I don't care what his motives are. I don't care what his motives are for ending the mass. Right. Well, I care more about his motives for ending the mass slaughter in Gaza, because you know that it's going to end with something a lot worse, probably. I don't know. We'll see. It's still at least he tried. He put in effort to stop the slaughter while feeding it.
And you can't help contrasting it with
the
New York Times and Democratic Party
and Biden.
Attitude toward Russia during Biden's term. Like,
Yes.
Ukrainians and Russians are killing each other. Wonderful.
Yeah. It's a great thing, yeah.
And Trump doesn't seem to like it as much. And just for that, the pig that this guy is, I still like him for that.
Yeah, he's doing the right thing. Wherever he's trying to end a war, you know, it's generally the right thing. And it's not because he's a good person. And Trump would be the last person. I mean, at least he's honest there. He'd be the last person. As he said, he's going to hell. So he's the last person that was him. You know, I'm a really good person. But it's a good thing. And I personally, because I have so much personally invested in, you know, in my life in Russia and Ukraine, and it was just, this war is always so unimaginable to me and to my wife and family.
Whereas I think the blob, or whatever we call it, had a different kind of investment in the same people.
Yes.
And they simply loved it when those people were killing each other.
I mean, I will remind you again, in Biden's interview in Time magazine in the spring of 2024, one of the very rare times he spoke, and it was a pretty weird, it was one of those times where it's like, man, this guy, people should really check on this guy's mental health more. But, the interviewers at Time asked him, you know, about his Ukraine war policy, and did he consider it was failing because the counteroffensive had failed and the Russians seemed to be, you know, were on the march at that time. It was pretty clear the momentum had totally shifted over the previous year. And he said, what are you talking about? Ukraine's killed 300,000 Russians. How is that a loss? This is a victory. Like, this is a success. It's an unprecedented success. So yeah, that's how they thought. But so that said, you know, Russian forces, their offensives, their ability to take land has accelerated. They've taken more land this year, more territory this year from Ukraine than they took last year. It's still not, you know, huge amounts by World War II standards. It's more like World War I standards. But it is attriting and hollowing out. Russia, of course, is also being hurt, but Ukraine is being, I mean, everybody admits this now, how much Ukraine has been. Well, I take that back. Not everyone has admitted it. I think in this country, because even elite media eventually, unlike Trump's first term and the second term, there's this weird kind of semi-falling in line with power, kind of like what you saw as Reagan got more popular. It's pretty weird. Right. And so they are kind of running stories. I mean, the New York Times a couple of days ago, I thought it was a great story. I mean, great in terms of journalism that gives you a sense of what's going on there. Very rare for the New York Times in the Ukraine war. You usually get the opposite. Usually it's like, you know, like Mykola and Oksana, you know, were teachers who were very patriotic and took up the charge to go to war to defend democracy. This one was about this guy from a village who was a doctor of some kind or had some medical training. And he's very shy. He's so shy, you know, he has a hard time like talking to people and stuff. And he found a wife who was like that. And they had these kids. And then he gets drafted to be a medic. And the first couple of tours, he does proper rotations, because that was what was going on with the Ukrainian forces, certainly in 2022, let's say, through early 2023, they were doing proper rotations. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why they performed so much better than the Russians in 2022, because the Russians were actually undermanned in 2022, and they weren't rotating. And the Ukrainians were full of enthusiastic volunteers, so they could rotate. But then things changed in 2023, as we know. And this guy was at some point put into a bunker somewhere at the front and left there with no rotation for something like 470 days. And this is what's going on with the Ukrainian military because of manpower issues. because he was so far forward at that point that they didn't want to risk, because drones are now can, you know, go 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers behind lines. That's where most of the killing's going on.
Right.
And so they didn't want to risk anybody to bring him out. And they needed him there because they couldn't replace him with anybody. And meanwhile,
it seems bizarre that they used a doctor like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's valuable training.
They're using people who are supposed to be like young special forces cadets and plugging them in collapsing lines at the front. Like it's so you are seeing real signs of the hollowing out,
right.
Which should be, you know, which is what's encouraging Putin. So Putin doesn't see the reason why he should sign a peace deal that doesn't give him everything he wants, because he's sure he's going to get everything he wants and more. And this is, you know, this is kind of the crux of the problem. And Zelensky, again, like Zelensky can't, like if Zelensky were a great man who did not think about himself and his clan, we're all getting busted in corruption deals right now. So he's obviously not that. He would do the hard sacrifice, which is you would agree to a really bad peace deal, save men, give up land, save men. Land can be retaken, as Mao would say, right? But that, yep. but your career's done. This, you're not a guerrilla movement, so you're done. You'll have to leave the country. But so he's not doing that, and he's being encouraged not to do that by the Europeans, who don't want the war to stop. The European political class does not want this war to stop. They're terrified of that possibility of a clear Russian victory and how that will destabilize their own credibility. And same with the media class, political class, the media class, and so on. That, because I keep seeing this, and you know, listeners in Europe can, as Brandt would say, confirm or disconfirm this. But what I keep hearing and seeing in most Europe and a lot of European, let's say Northern European countries, is that most of the media seems to be saying that Russia is the one that's being hollowed out. Russia is close to collapsing. The Ukrainians are holding out. I mean, as bad and dire as their situation is, they are still fighting. They're not, as far as I can tell, about to collapse tomorrow. It's a slow hollowing out process. But right. That's not what the Europeans, I don't think, are being told. I think it'll be a shock in a lot of countries if Ukraine were to collapse.
And when they see that people like doctors, trained doctors, are actually being used to plug holes.
Well, he wasn't being used to plug a hole up in the trench in the front, as far as I could tell. Although, you know, now that you mention it, the reporting on it was a little iffy. Like, we do know that they were taking anti-aircraft gunners and using them to plug holes. We do know that they take like Hare Krishnas, they're dragging people off the streets. Yeah. And if you can't bribe, it's all a bribing system. And if you can't bribe your way out, you get stuck in the front. I gathered that he was at the very front part because they needed a medic up there. And that he eventually got left behind because other, you know, people with money and so on sort of backing away as Russian drone warfare was able to hit further and further behind lines. And they just got left. And I think a lot of Ukrainians are left like that. And that's why lines that are considered pro-Ukrainian and are like technically Ukrainian, they get overrun very easily in certain circumstances. And that's just in the last couple of weeks, two really important kind of fortress towns, Siversk and Huliopole, which is where Nestor Makhno is from, the famous anarchist. Both of those got overrun. In fact, in Huliopole, the Russians had tried getting near it since the beginning of the war. And it just all fell apart. I watched this thing develop. I watched them shape it, but it really just fell apart in a matter of weeks. And parts of the line collapsed so quickly that Russian, you know, infiltrators were able to take a battalion command post with all the computers, all the logs, all the maps, all the classified info. Like they fled.
Wow. They're,
I know that, and that hasn't happened in the war. I've never heard of something like that happening in this war. Bad sign for you know, the Ukraine. But like I said, like I don't think most Europeans, at least in the North, are getting this view of things. So that's why Putin doesn't see the need to compromise. He's trying to, I think Putin wants, you know, obviously sees a big advantage in Trump and wants to, doesn't want to piss off Trump, who you have to show respect to, you have to show deference to. Like the Russians want Trump to be sympathetic. So they're kind of trying to walk this tightrope. And same with the Ukrainians. So Trump eventually kind of tries to push on Ukraine a deal that, although it's not what Putin and the Russians want, is definitely much more in their favor, because the way Trump sees it, Ukraine's losing. I mean, I think actually Trump sees how things really, I think in this case, they're seeing things a lot more clearly than other people.
Yeah, because his ego is not involved here.
Yeah.
It's like, and he's sensible enough when,
yeah,
when it's a matter of profit and loss in the abstract.
I mean, he's not invested in the Ukraine war cause, because the Ukraine war cause was always tied up with Biden, liberals, and anti-MAGA, and the politics of anti-right-wing, you know, right, as they call it, right-wing populism, which I hate. But, you know, like the pro-Ukraine war cause is thick as, is, you know, intertwined with the politics of opposing what Trump's politics are. And that's just a fact. And that's a bad gamble. That was a gamble that is now, you know.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Yeah. Like, why did the Ukraine government do that? It's strange. But it's one of the many anomalies of this war.
Yeah. So I don't see, I think that's just one thing to note, is that it looks again like, you know, this peace deal, which they, like, he's definitely bringing them closer to a peace deal. I hope it happens. It would be great if it happens. But as far as I can tell right now, it doesn't look like it. Like, I think Zelensky left Mar-a-Lago, if I read this right, saying that he's willing to put this latest peace deal, which would force Ukraine to give up more land than they've actually lost, in exchange for some of the other land Russia's taken and for, like, you know, an end to hostilities. He said he'll put it to a vote in a referendum, which is a way of saying, the most polite way of saying it's not going to happen.
Right.
And then, according to the Russians, at least, just before we started recording, Ukraine sent 71 attack drones to attack a Putin residence in Novgorod, and they were apparently all shot down, but the Russians are now promising, you know, a big response, and then that will give everybody an excuse to say no more ceasefire talk, you know. So I don't really see how that's going to do that. The other thing I wanted to say is this, you know, and this goes with the way that the Northern Europeans and the British are kind of framing the war. I think British intelligence said this year alone, like this year is the deadliest year for Russians, and that, I don't know, 100 or 200,000 Russians were killed or something like this. I can't remember how many they said, something huge. And it may be, the UK defense ministry, when it comes to Russia, has proven to be very, very unreliable. You know, like General Westmoreland, basically, levels. But one thing I just, a conundrum I want to say here is this, that, and this is widely reported in, you know, in all the pro-Ukraine press as well. When the Russians advance, they advance in these DRG, in these like infiltrator teams. They go on like motorcycle, scooter, bicycle, horseback even. They're going on horseback sometimes because you can't do, or it's very hard now, unless there's fog and so on, to do any kind of mass advance. I mean, to even mass any forces and then advance, because drones can see everything and then hit everything, you know, at least a good 20 miles, I guess, you know, 12 to 20 miles behind lines. So what they do is they take, you know, large areas now with extremely few people. Mm. So how are they
hardly
losing?
Because those lines are hollow, right?
Exactly. So the Ukrainian lines are hollow. The Russians can't mass armor and fort and manpower. So they're it's a really weird. You know, this is where all the analogies just break down with this war. This war is going to be creating analogies for other wars.
Yeah.
Other wars' analogies aren't really working. They all break down with this war. So I just wonder where all these people are getting killed if so few people are at least in the front part of the kill zone. And I guess the answer to that is that there's so many people, the kill zone is so wide now that so many people are being killed in this much wider kill zone. But, you know, nevertheless, we don't know. I mean, casualties, war dead, these are all propaganda tools, and we won't know the truth. And certainly our fearless independent media won't bother digging into the truth about actual casualty counts. We just know that we'll be given casualty counts that are meant to keep up spirits and keep the war fight going, that, you know, everything's on the up and up. And we'll only know the truth, you know, some years after the war. Events in Ukraine did a good piece on casualties. He had a good Substack on that recently. And, you know, I think his basic point was that it seems that both sides are attriting at roughly the same raw numbers, but that been killed and wounded, but that Ukraine is actually, its actual force level is shrinking constantly because of how many people are going AWOL, you know, mass desertion, and their inability to forcibly mobilize enough people on the Ukraine side, whereas on the Russian side, even Kirill Budanov, the head of the HUR, the military intelligence of Ukraine, I think it was he who admitted, and, you know, Western estimates too, that Russia is still exceeding its annual targets for recruitment for contract soldiers. So it's constantly able to replenish at a plus rate, even at higher levels of estimated Russian casualties. And whereas Ukraine's military probably lost in the area of 100, I think Peter came up with 100 to 180,000.
Wow.
They're just not able to replenish. So anyway, we'll talk more about that. You know, the big war story that Trump is and his administration, Stephen Miller and Marco Rubio are trying to get going, of course, is a war with Venezuela. And, you know, I think John, as we said in the break, like that's just too big of a story. Well, we're going to save that. We're actually going to do an episode very soon with Anya Pramble. I'm looking forward to that. She wrote a really good book that goes into the details of how the U.S., empire operates outside of direct, outside of just the direct kinetic ways. It's really outrageous material, and I'm looking forward to talking with her about it. Did you want to say a word, John, maybe about one of the other wars, like Cambodia, Thailand, or India, Pakistan?
Well, I think one of the other ones we mentioned or we had on our list was a little kerfuffle. I don't mean to be dismissive, but a little kerfuffle between India and Pakistan. But the interesting thing about this, and it can be stated very briefly, is that they're both nuclear powers now. Nobody has anything to gain. They are somewhat used to being part of small confrontations like this. And factions within both countries are able to use these small confrontations to let off a bit of steam. So I don't think, and God knows, I don't want to be wrong at the expense of many mushroom clouds over the subcontinent, but it doesn't seem like they're going to be dangerous confrontations.
That raised a really interesting question, because I don't know if you've seen this, John. There, a lot of the pro-Ukraine war cause crowd has, they often say like the first betrayal was the Budapest Memorandum in 1994.
Made them give up their nukes.
Yeah. There's a big question about how much they didn't have control of those nukes. It's right. Like saying that Turkey, this is the other argument, that Turkey has control.
Let alone Utah.
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, you know, they pledged not to develop nukes, and they made that pledge, and, you know, and it didn't work. But my question is sort of like, if they had a few nukes, would that, I don't think that would have stopped Russia for this confrontation,
no.
But Russia had made it clear over and over. In fact, there were just some classified conversations recently released. I don't know if you've seen these. Conversations between Bush and Putin, where Putin keeps saying over and over, if you try and move NATO into Ukraine, this is for us a strategic red line. It cannot happen. And at one point, I could just see W's that you just see Putin giving this like paragraph long, you know, discussion of this without any sort of, there's no like anger or emotion, just kind of stating as fact. And then it says, Bush, colon, why? Sums it up. And I think that's really like, that kind of describes probably Michael McFaul and, you know, all of them. Why?
Yeah.
Why can't we? I'm not sure that nukes will, put it this, I was trying to think about this. So nukes didn't prevent India and Pakistan from having at least low-level fights, border skirmishes, air battles. Nukes for North Korea definitely worked, because ultimately we didn't really care about North Korea, right? Like,
yeah. We
didn't want them to get nukes because it felt like the whole world would end. But once they got it, it was like, okay, so what? So what are they going to do? Like, we actually don't want to go to war against you know, North Korea. South Korea doesn't
want to. You've got a single shot revolver there. What are you going to do? Shoot me? I've got a machine gun.
Yeah, and for what? It's not like we're after North Korean real estate, right? Yeah. I mean, the empire wants to force them to submit. And so they didn't submit. Okay, they didn't submit. So stay where you are. Like, it didn't change anything. But from Russia's point of view, and the Russian, you know, ruling classes and elites definitely believe this, that, and, you know, I think a lot of people in international relations would probably agree to one degree or another that NATO-izing Ukraine is a threat to Russian power. And so they're willing to risk a lot more than we are over North Korea. Like, so long as North Korea doesn't try to expand into South Korea, I don't think anyone really cares that much.
Yep.
So we're pooping. You know, there was a lot obviously went on. We haven't really touched on. We didn't touch on the Iran Israel war, the 12-day war. I think the one thing we can maybe if we want to do a quick roundup of that, John, I think the takeaways I would have are that Iran did not collapse, which it seems that the Israelis tried to get a state collapse there. It didn't work. And that, again, here we are talking about nukes. Ballistic missiles kind of, like, if you build enough of them, they can kind of do the job without nukes.
Yeah, and not only did the missiles get through, but Israel took a lot of security measures to clamp down on anybody trying to release estimates of damage.
Right.
So they probably did do a lot of damage.
Right. And it rapidly depleted both the Israeli, you know, air defense systems and even, you know, the gold-plated THAAD system, the one that works apparently the best. I think we ran through about a third of all of our systems just over that tiny little war, which gives you a sense of how our whole military is structured in this country. But, you know, that's something to keep an eye on, because Netanyahu has come out and said that the ballistic missiles, he's basically admitted what we're saying here, which is Iran's ballistic missile program actually is a threat. It's not the nukes that are the threat, it's the ballistic missiles. Right. And they're still threatening us, and we're going to do something again. So probably going to see something there in 2026, unfortunately. All right. I am pooped. Yeah. End of the year, I'm ready to plop down and fall asleep again. And I'll see you in 2026.
We'll see everybody in 2026.
Yeah. Thank you again, everyone. Yeah. Thanks for a great year for Radio War Nerd. A lot of great guests this year and great episodes. And thanks again, everyone. And thank you, Brendan, too. Happy holidays. Yep. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.